From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Herta Saunders lasted just 9 more months in her job after she'd been diagnosed with early onset dementia. Her fraying memory, she says, made it impossible to continue her work as a teacher and an administrator at the University of Utah. For a retirement present, her colleagues gave her a leather-bound journal, and she started documenting the day-to-day experience of having dementia. She called the journal Field Notes, Dementia Field Notes. She says she wanted to be like an anthropologist observing a tribe. But she couldn't be completely detached from dementia, so she also began writing something very personal about the experience. Saunders' book is being released this week. She's joining us today to talk about what losing her memory is doing to her identity. Join us after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, wealth advisors since 1982. Albion values local organizations helping to enrich the community through the power of ideas. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Herta Saunders had not set out to write a book about dementia. She was diagnosed with early onset dementia in 2010, and she was writing about it. At first, it was just clinical observations in a journal she called Dementia Field Notes. But over time, she felt compelled to tell her story from the inside, is how she puts it. So she wrote an essay and then another one. And now she has a memoir just published just this week. Writing a book while coping with dementia, as you can imagine, is not easy, especially when you're trying to focus your remaining energy on the things that really matter. But Herta has said she felt a duty to write this book so she could shed light on the confusion and the sense of shrinking self-image that always accompanies a diagnosis. We recorded a conversation with her last week. Herta Saunders served as an associate director for the University of Utah's Gender Studies program. Her memoir is called Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia. She's giving readings this month in Salt Lake City. We'll give you details about that as we go along. And I should also mention, we've been producing a series of short films with Herta. We've just published the fourth one. You can watch it at radiowest.org. So I want to begin, Herta, with September 21st, 2010. This is 5 days before you turned 61. How did your doctor break the news to you? And what was your just first initial reaction?
The whole process of diagnosis took a while, and it was not as though on that day I had no inkling that something might happen. But what really got to me was when I spoke to my then psychoneurologist, and she said to me, "It seems that you've already been dementing." And hearing the word dementing used in a verb form, and that was something that I was doing, really put a new image of it in my mind. It seemed so personal and active in a way. And also, in a way, comforting to hear that word, and also to know that clearly I had already been doing this, and here I am. The
Things
world
hadn't
fallen
apart. Yeah.
No. So here I am. And It also made me think about what this implies, because my mother had dementia, and Peter and I knew what it looks like. And I feel my mother had been always so very well cared for that we maybe did not see so many of the behind-the-scenes things as we see now. But even with that filtered view of my mother's dementia, it brought us into a twin state, me with my mother, that seemed very much more personal. But it goes beyond that for me. I think that naming something or putting a word to something is a way of announcing it to the world as something that you recognize and not necessarily accept, but you recognize it and you own it.
Yeah. But your mother didn't want that official diagnosis. You say in the book, my mother's deterioration had gone without a name.
I don't think that it was that my mother didn't want it. It was just not the custom.
Yeah.
And also this was my mother by now has been dead for 10 years and she was first showed very obvious signs of dementia even 10 years before that. So we're talking about 20 years ago. And plus this is in South Africa in a culture where the drive for diagnosis is not as strong in the case of old age diseases as it is here. So the notion of even having attested, should a test have been available,
yeah,
was just not part of the discussion, I believe.
You write this, we were afraid the quest for a diagnosis could trap us in what the writer and physician Atul Gawande once described as the seemingly unstoppable momentum of medical treatment. Well, explain that, because on one hand you say it was important to have a name for this, but on the other hand, you worried about what that diagnosis would mean for you?
Yes, I think that Peter and I spoke about maybe having a diagnosis. It could have been almost as much as a year before we actually decided to do it. It was not just a light decision because we researched this, of course, what we could find out of dementia on the internet. And as far as I knew at the time, there was really not much treatment for any kind of dementia. There are little life vests that are thrown out in the form of medications that might retard it for a while or that might make a difference. But even then, I did not think that even taking those would make such a huge difference to the quality of my life that I felt it was really urgent. It was not as though I had discovered something in my heart, blood system being wrong. So we didn't want to get into this medical test, then another medical test. Then those things can go on endlessly.
Yeah.
And at each point, we discussed with the doctor what the next step would be. And our family physician left it up to us. She said to us what the possibilities were, what we might get out of a diagnosis. But I think you asked about the effect that being connected with a medical environment can do. And as I said, there are all these tests, but there's also the pressure to try like the various snake oils around. And I have had so many suggestions from people about very different things that I could take to try. And to me, it would be like spending my life on this quest for things. And we were absolutely very sure that we did not want to get into that.
But at what point did you and Peter decide, okay, I guess it's time for a diagnosis?
I think that I can't remember the particular incident, but there were incidents. This one is uppermost in my mind, so it could have been that. When the kids were over, I think it was Easter, I imagine, because we were planning a brunch. And I had made a casserole for which I'd even looked up a recipe, which I never do, an Amish casserole. And I'd made it the night before because it looked like it would take a while to prepare. So I'd made it up to the point of where it had to be baked.
Yeah.
And then the next day, I set the table and I got everything ready. And then when everybody was there and everybody was sitting at the table, I discovered that I had not baked the casserole. And it really caused me to have a little meltdown.
Really?
And my family was, that my children were just incredible. They immediately jumped in. You know, they gave the kids, you know, an apple or something to make them last. And they baked the casserole and they just took over. I was really so upset. And not just upset like a prima donna, but just it had touched me on a deep level of knowledge.
Yeah. Because that represented a reality of what you knew inside was going on.
Yeah, a manifestation of this dysfunction that my kids had seen before.
So for them, did this also represent that? They knew what was going on. Mom isn't just upset about a casserole.
Yeah.
Mom is upset because this is confirming something she knows inside. She has dementia.
Yes, I believe it was that for them because we had spoken about them, about my memory losses and other lapses with them before. And they never were dismissive. They never said to me, you know, only senior moments, except, you know, we would joke about it as that. But they believed me. And I think it's also because I had already seen proof of it.
Yeah. There's a moment that you tell in the book, a story that happened at a couple's home. And this was in Raleigh, North Carolina. And there was a gay man who was there who told everyone at the table this very sad story that you explain in the book of this woman saying to this man, dismissing him basically because he was gay, that he was a homo, as she put it. And the man, the gay man, was deeply disturbed by that. He said the lights of the world went out for him. But here's what you say in the book about that. But over time, over a long time, the light of the world came back on for him, and he felt, this is how you put it, bloated with relief. And in the days after your diagnosis, it seems, this story came to you. Now, explain that.
Yes. I think I used to work in at the University of Utah as the associate director of the gender studies program. So for me, this a coming out story in the sense of people who are sexually non-normative became to me like a metaphor of coming out in many other areas of life. The fact that that story came to me was very meaningful. And I think I remembered the phrase he said, the lights of the world went out. And actually, when he told the story, he did not seem to show hurt for what the woman said. He showed a kind of gratitude for somebody giving him a word by which he could reinterpret himself. And I think that may be why the story came up to me, because for him, homo was the word that brought him into a certain reality. And for me, dementing was that word. I just have to add that later in the book, I say that I had completely misremembered this particular story. I had conflated his story with many other stories I'd heard from people in gender studies. And I think maybe particularly in Utah, where people who grew up in very religious environments really did not have the vocabulary to think of themselves.
Your short-term memory is shaky, as you explain. But you also say in the book that your memories from your childhood in South Africa seem to persist fairly well. Or certainly they did anyway when you were writing this. Is it still true?
Yes. It seems to me that what is the case in many kinds of memory loss, and I think certainly also in Alzheimer's, about which I think more has been found out than other dementias. But it seems that people retain those very, very first memories often to the last. So that in my case, too, I feel that my memory is very, very vivid. I think also it's at a time when you are learning language, and some of those memories are maybe pre-verbal, and so that you have images of them that you then describe in adult language, which may not exactly match the events of the time. But I think they are true in the way that stories are true, because it, I think for me, the meaning of those events live on, even if I should remember some details of it incorrectly.
So do you think in some way, as your dementia progresses, that you may lose the capacity to explain the memory or the word of the memory, but the image will be with you to the last?
I'm not so confident of that.
Really?
Because I think that that verbal memory contributes enormously to the evocation of images. And I think developmentally...
So you need the words for the
images. I need the words for the image. I mean, I think developmentally, when you think of small children, that we do not remember our very vivid images of the world that we get to know the first time in the first year or year and a half. But we do remember from a certain point onward, you remember something. And I think very often that memory is embedded in language.
Yeah.
It was for me.
Herta Saunders. Her memoir is called Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia. On June 22nd, the King's English Bookshop is hosting Herta's book launch party. She'll also be giving a reading on June 29th. That's at the Art Access Gallery. There are details on our website, radiowest.org. There's also a link to our latest short film with Herta. It's a rumination on her terrific sense of style and whether all the effort she puts into her appearance will be worth it when she can no longer manage it herself. Again, you can see it at radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with Herta Saunders, who was diagnosed with a progressive form of dementia in 2010. She was 61 at the time. She's written a memoir about her experience, and today in the program, we're talking about it. It's called Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia. There's a story that you tell about being with your father. This was when you were quite young. I think you were four years old. You had seen this white in the distance, and you thought it was sand. So you thought, let's go play in the sand. It's a beach. Your father said, no, these are strips of cheesecloth. And he told you the word for it. And that gave you a sense of the importance of words. Would you talk about that?
Yes, certainly. So my father took me with him one day when he went out to the lands, the fields where the tobacco was being planted. And the earth there was very dark, a dark, black, rich, moist earth. And in the midst of this black earth, in the plowed area by the side of the road, there were these strips of white. And when I saw them, I had this happy feeling of memories at the beach. And I said, I want to go play in the sand. Mm. And my father then, he was puzzled, but he figured it out. Then he said to me, it's not sand. And he, you know, very sweetly explained the Afrikaans word. Immediately, it was like a slide moves in front of your face from one slide to another. Suddenly, I saw that it was the cheesecloth, because I was present when my mother prepared the cheesecloth, sewing those strips for days. And my sister and I had played in this all this lovely soft fabric that was everywhere. And immediately that word connected me to being in the presence and the feel of that cheesecloth when I was playing with it. And then I looked at the beds again and I wanted them to be sand again, but they would not become sand again. And I thought that how miraculous is it that a word could change sand into cheesecloth.
Iris Murdoch, you write about, she's the great British writer and philosopher, of course, who was afflicted with dementia, with Alzheimer's. And you put this in the book, that she wrote about how redemption comes through words. This is how you put it. Myself is only what I say, and only by opening myself to the pain of my words can I attain the redemptive pleasure of claiming to be a self at all. Talk to me about that. Are you, what you're saying is that we are our words. We are our memories. Is that what you're getting at there?
Yes. We are our memories, but for me, the words were always, they were the medium in which I could, at each step of my life, define myself as a particular kind of self. And I really, those words of Iris Murdoch, or the concept of hers that words make a self, really struck me very personally, especially in the light of her then total loss of words through dementia. There's a line that I quote in the book. I can't remember exactly the words, but it's like nonsense words, like sustan pujan, that she said to her husband. And so she had no language in the end. And this woman who had written so prolifically and who was known for using the most extraordinary words, she suddenly was bereft of words. And to me, it seems to me that my worthwhile life will end, I think, at approximately the time that I have no words left. Because for me, the way to reach people is mostly through words. There is the direct contact of bodies, which I value very highly. And I think that as long as one has a body to hold, I think that is an enormously important thing. I think especially for people with dementia. In fact, I think for any old people, because that is what you hear so much, that older people don't have anyone to hold them. So I think that is another way of relating to people. But for me, words is it's the most important.
There's another thing about that moment you tell about Iris Murdoch, where she is just speaking these nonsense words to her husband, John Bailey. And I wanted to ask you about this moment of that story. So there came this day when, and I'm just going to read from the
Certainly.
Book, this is you. There came a day when Iris laid her hand on John Bailey's knee and said these words, nonsense words. Bailey needed no more help than her hand gentling his cheek to distill from this jumble the grammar of love. And this made me think of Peter, your husband. The moment I'm imagining when he's going to have to discern from your own, forgive me, gibberish, the grammar of love. Does that make you think of that?
It does make me think of that. It seems to me that is a moment I don't really even want to reach in my life. I feel that if that kind of gibberish is a comfort to him or to anyone else, you know, that is just fine. But I think that in many cases, as in Iris Murdoch's case, her gibberish did not always come as an expression of love.
Right.
It was just as often an expression of anger or fear or anxiety. And I feel that for me, once the negative expressions, no matter whether it's in body language or in actual language or in gibberish, when that communication mostly turns to anger or to estranging gestures or acts, I hope that I would not get to a point like that.
You want to be, before you get there, you want to end your life.
I do. And of course, I can't end my life because I will need help to do that, unless I do it prematurely to be able to do it by myself, which I really don't want to do.
Right. But you think about that?
Oh, I don't think about it every day because our family has discussed it and made plans for it, and it's something I can now put aside peacefully.
I want to come back to that.
Sure.
I know that's not easy, but one of the things you do write about late in the book is this list of signs that you want your friends and family to pay attention to that may reveal when you've gotten to that point where, as you put it, you've fallen below that level of acceptability. Mm-hmm. You don't want to get to the point of gibberish.
Yes.
And one of those signs is a question that you ask, do I revert to the racism I learned as a child in apartheid South Africa? Because this is something that happened to your mother. Because you say your mother, as she was declining in this retirement center, she still had a loving disposition at times, but also there were moments when, as you say, her sense of tolerance would evaporate, when she would be superior and entitled and rude, and that racism would come out. Would you talk to me a little bit about that? Do you worry that this might happen to you in some way? I don't think you ever were racist in the same way your mother, but you were exposed to a lot of it in South Africa.
Yes, I certainly was, and as a child in particular. And I think those impressions that one gets as a child stick very deeply. And I am, with my whole being, I have resisted racism in myself my whole life. Since I was, you know, maybe a 14, 15-year-old child who had become aware of the situation in South Africa. But I confess that sometimes I see a person of color, and I always, my first thought is, what have they come to fix or clean? And it's an admission that is... It does not happen to me often, but it has happened enough that I know that racism is just there's a thinnest veneer of rationality over it. And I have no doubt that when my rationality goes, my ability to exert my reason will go. And I've seen that not only with my mother, but with so many older people. And not only in South Africa, I see it here too. The more your rationality goes, the more you go back to distinctions you made in childhood.
I guess that gets to a big question. Does dementia make you revert to some true unfiltered version of who you are?
That's a difficult question for me, because I don't think there is a true version of who one is.
Yeah.
I think you're always a layered object of so many selves. And I think while you are rational, you can pull forward the selves yet that you feel are honorable and ethical. But they are, as more rationally determined versions of yourself drop away, I think those pre-verbal or very, very early childhood versions come out. Like the selfishness, the solipsism of childhood, you know, it's all about me. And people get like that when they have dementia. There's no consideration for any other person. I mean, they can't be because there's no reason to do that with.
Herta Saunders. Her memoir is called Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia. The King's English Bookshop is going to be hosting Herta's book launch party on June 22nd. She's also giving a reading on June 29th at the Art Access Gallery. You can find details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Herta Saunders. We're talking about her book, Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia. In the book, you have these, occasionally, you include these dialogues that you have with your brain. One of them where you write about Don Quixote, and you quote Harold Bloom. Where Bloom says Don Quixote can remain a hero only as long as he retains his crazy will to be himself, as long as he keeps up the war against Freud's reality principle. Now, I don't want to get into all of that because that's great, but then your response is, if remaining yourself means you must fight reality, you decline. You, Herta, must live and die by reason. Reason is so important for you. The idea of being objective about your condition is really important to you. Throughout, you write about the fact that you wanted to be like an anthropologist. You wanted to make a dispassionate, like a scientist, observation of what was happening to you. Now, let me just ask you about that. As your dementia progresses, does it become more difficult to be objective, to just assign reason to all of this? Or do you find yourself being more subjective, more personal, more... Do you know what I mean?
I think it feels to me as though I can still ultimately operate with reason, not always in the moment. I get very confused and I forget. So Peter and I have the strangest conversations where we're discussing something. And for example, he had just made like a suggestion that, for example, we can't go and, you know, do our errands right now because I'm waiting for the man who's coming to see what's wrong with our lawn. And then in that same conversation, a few seconds later, I would say, well, maybe we should first go and have coffee before we go and do this. And then it's very exasperating to him because it's in the same breath that I'm saying that. And that clearly is not, it's not a rational way of dealing with the moment. But the rationality still stays for me in the sense that I can immediately say to him, I'm sorry, I just got confused or I forgot. So I'm still, my rationality works in such a way that I can still know that I am being irrational.
Right.
But I want to talk more about the whole notion of the importance of the reality or the, for reality for me or being rational is the exertion of human intelligence over your immediate environment.
Yeah.
To me, I think it's not fashionable at the moment to be a an existentialist in the sense of Paul Sartre, and I think I am an existentialist in that way, but I still feel that a guiding thought in my life is that existence precedes essence, which is, of course, what Sartre said, that you first exist and then you find the rational reason for existing. You don't exist for a reason. You invent and make that reason as you live your life. And to me, that is, for me, what sentient life is about. I think our cells have a biological imperative to keep on living. I mean, people lie there hooked up to machines, and your cells and your heart and everything just won't die. But when you've lost the ability to make a rational sense out of that, when you no longer have the intellectual capacity to even know that that is what your body is doing, to me, that is not a worthwhile life. And you've named some of the ways in which I define it. But that, to me, is when you can no longer I don't want to say intellectually, that's too elite a word, but when you can no longer, through being sensible of your environment and of other people, when you can no longer make a mark on the world in that to me is when biological life really does not need to go on.
This really does get, to me anyway, to one of the most essential questions really of all of this, and that is, what is the point at which your life is no longer worth living? So there are these questions, we mentioned this before, these questions that you asked, signs that you want your family to pay attention to, because you don't want to get to this point. One of them is, will I still be or have a self when my reason is gone? You ask yourself that question. Do you have an answer for that one? Will I still have a self when my reason is gone? Or am I just a husk at that point, I guess?
I do believe that for some people, you become just a husk. And I think that the self that you have or had has been transposed into the people who love you. You live on inside them.
Yeah.
And you don't need your body for that anymore. And for me, I want my family to know the things. I want them, and in describing what I don't think of as being a worthwhile life anymore, I am almost quoting things that my family members have said to me about other people. You know, it must be so hard to have someone you care for who shouts at you, or who doesn't recognize you, or who doesn't, no speaking or anything like that. And so those are criteria that I have not thought up at the moment of thinking about this in the context of dementia. Those are things we've discussed in our family for many, many years about when people die, and we would discuss, you know, what was their life like, and was death really the most terrible thing that could happen to them? So we have a context for this to talk about it.
Here are some of the signs that you list, some of the questions you ask. The point at which you don't want to get to this point, basically. Do I wake up most days feeling joyful and excited about my new day, no matter the level of intellectual activity I am capable of? Do I look forward to more things than I dread? Do I appear and act happy for more hours per day than I appear and act unhappy? Do I complain frequently about loneliness and depression and boredom? Do I sleep most of the day? And then it goes on. And this last one, am I physically approachable without getting myself into a state of fear or anger? That is it still a pleasure for me to cuddle with a friend or child or grandchild? In other words, do I still provide and enjoy the comfort of a warm body? How do you know the point when you need to, I'll just say it, how do you know when it's getting close to being too late? When do you make that decision?
It will not be a decision that I can make.
Yeah.
And this is the very, very hard thing about it, because I'm asking my family to keep this in mind as I approach that point. My family, every single one of them, and I, it's Peter, it's my daughter Marissa, her husband Adam, my son Newton, his wife Cheryl. All of them have gone through these discussions with us, have gone to the lawyer with us, have drawn up the papers. Every one of them is a medical power of attorney for me. And I'm asking them to keep this into consideration as that point approaches. Because they would want this for themselves, they have all agreed to do this for me, to seek an assisted death for me, a legal assisted death, even if it should mean going to a different country. But I am not, I have also, in the same breath and in the same document, I have said that I am asking this of you as a huge gift to me. And that if you cannot give me that gift, or if some of you at the time feel they cannot give me this gift, I ask you not to stop those of you who may feel they still can do it for me. And that is all I can ask. I would at no point ask them to act against their ethical sense of what is right for that time and for that moment.
You write, love must be big enough when the time comes to let go.
Yes, and that applies to me, because there's no guarantee that another one of my family members might not need this gift from me and from the rest of us, because things happen to young, healthy people too, where people who love them might have to make a decision about whether to continue their life through extreme medical measures or not to. In my case, it is different because I'm an older person. I will likely not be on the verge of dying at the time, not physically on the verge of dying. And there is a plan B, which is this. I can, as long as I don't wait too long, I can hasten my death through something that is not illegal, and that is to ask that all food and drink be withheld from me. That takes, if you're lucky, about 10 days or so to put you in organ failure, at which case you will be admitted to a hospice. Now, remember, you can't be admitted to a hospice unless you're 6 months away from death. And with dementia, you can hardly ever say that somebody is 6 months away from death. So I could get to a hospice where I would get to I would get access to our country's current way of providing assisted death without calling it that, and that is access to so much pain medication or other psychotic drugs that I probably will die sooner than I would have if I hadn't done that. But I'm asking my family to take me to a place of beauty and dignity where there can be beautiful flowers in the room, there can be my favorite music playing, I can be holding the hands of all my relatives, versus I'm asking them to, every time I ask them for a drink or for food, to remind me that I don't want the drink or food because I want to die. And I know of one documented case of a person with dementia who has managed to do that. But what is the harder one that I'm asking of my family?
What do you think?
So much of my relationships with my family and with other people are built around the consumption of food and drink. It is a primary way of being together and of showing love. I come from a family where if you don't eat your whole plate and a second one and a third one, you don't love the person who made it.
Right.
We spend a lot of time having meals together. And it would be very hard for me to refuse a drink or food to someone I love. It would be very, very hard. I don't know if it might be very much harder to actually book that plane ticket and go somewhere. But I don't know. It will be up to my children to decide. To me, it seems that the plan of having a planned assisted death is kinder.
Let me ask you, what's different today in the way you perceive the world, in the way you account for reality, than 6 months ago? What's different?
It's hard to pin it down to 6 months ago, but, you know, in the last years since I've had my diagnosis, I feel that I can still understand large, logical, interconnected systems, you know, or plans. And I'm still very strongly embedded in narrative. I can follow a story, but I can't follow a newscast, you know, or unless it's very story-like. And so I think that a reality for me, it's true. I feel that my grasp on reality is slipping, but I mostly feel that is still located into my interaction with the material world. I bumble so much when I'm trying to do things with objects in the world. I break them, or I drop them, or I can't find them, or I use them incorrectly. So in that sense, I very strongly feel that my able to deal with physical reality, you know, in the way that you touch it, is not good. But I feel that my way of dealing with reality in the larger understandings of how the world works and what, you know, how I think my creation story for myself, I feel that those are not less clear to me. Of course, I don't always trust my sense of reality, and I ask my family members to correct me, and they very happily do. But I have no doubt that happens even at times when people don't let me know, or they kind of get what I mean, so they don't correct me.
There's, in one of those dialogues in the book, you fold Einstein into the dialogue along with, or at least the conversation, with your brain and you. And in this section, you say to your brain, how could you fail me? Let me count the ways. Your brain says, don't count the days. Make the days count. And Einstein says, everything that can be counted does not necessarily matter. Everything that matters cannot necessarily be counted. Is that what you're thinking about?
Oh, yes, I do. I think I am much more receptive to other ways of living and experiencing joy than through one's intellect. Well, of course, it's difficult. Intellect is not the right word. It's more like your senses. But for me, sense, of course, for everybody, sense include your auditory sense. And so it's also what you hear, and what you hear is very often words. So for me, the words part has also always weighed very heavily. But I very much enjoy just feeling more open to the world. And I think this isn't actually an effect of the disease, that your focus kind of dissolves into the moment. So I'm much more responsive to what is right before my eyes than I had ever been before. So I see something interesting or beautiful or a color, or it need not even be beautiful. I see something and my mind goes there. Which is very distracting in many ways, because I'm trying to get one thing done that's in my mind, I have a plan, but the world keeps on distracting me from it. But I have been much more inclined to try to build my life so that I can give in to those distractions. Hmm. So I can just sit and just be and just let things just be in front of me. And in a world of wanting to be efficient and, wanting to be productive, that is not an attitude most of us can afford. You have to keep focused. And for me, keeping focused is a very, very big part of my day, and it drains a lot of emotional energy, which makes it all the nicer to have those moments when I can just let go. I never used to go anywhere without a book, because I could not bear to sit somewhere without a book. But now I mostly don't take a book with, or a radio, or music, or anything. I just like just to sit there and just be in that moment where I am. And it need not be with other people. It need not be a spectacular place. It could be the doctor's waiting room. But I just want to be where I am without having to constantly have to force my head into another place.
Herta Saunders. Her book is Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia. Her book launch party is June 22nd. That's at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. She's also giving a reading at the Art Access Gallery. That's on June 29th. You can get details to all of this on our website, radiowest.org. That's where you can see a series of short films that we've been producing with Herta. We've been following her on her journey with dementia. In the fourth installment, Herta asks this question: is all the effort she puts into her appearance really worth it once she can no longer manage it herself? Go see it at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our films are created by Kelsey Moore. Thanks also to our intern, Zoe Wolf McGinn. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.